Hi, and welcome to Hyperfixations, the podcast where we invite various interesting people on to talk about their niche area of interest that they could just talk forever about. Here are your hosts. I'm Ali.
And I'm Nigel.
And today we have Nick. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Glad to hear. So tell us, what are you here to talk to us about today?
I am here to talk about the fantasy series, The Earthsea Cycle by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Nice.
Okay, perfect. Why The Earthsea Cycle? How did you first get into it, and why have you brought it for the show today?
Well, when I was a child, I was introduced by my uncle to fantasy via The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Shortly after, around the age of 12 or 13-ish, I discovered Harry Potter, and I sort of, at the time, fell in love with the idea of a school for wizards. But as I've gotten older, I've sort of become disenfranchised.
We all know how that turned out.
Yes. I've steadily become more and more disenfranchised with the whole thing with Harry Potter. And around 2018, 2019, I really started to look for a replacement of sorts. And you can't go very far in the realm of fantasy without hearing the name Ursula K. Le Guin. And it was unfortunately after her death that I learned of A Wizard of Earthsea, which is, to my great surprise, the first fantasy book about a school for wizards. And So I had to jump on that very quickly. And I immediately fell in love. And it's slowly replaced Lord of the Rings as what I think is probably the best epic fantasy from the 20th century.
Okay,
interesting.
Yeah, like, I'm definitely intrigued. Like, you had my interest, and now you have my attention. So, for anyone who, like, doesn't know anything about the Earthsea, like, tell us a bit about them. Like, what's it all about?
So, the Earthsea Cycle takes place on Earthsea, which is a world, as you can imagine, covered by a sea. There are no primary main land masses. Largely, it takes place in an archipelago of neighboring city-states and small nations that are connected by songs and similar histories and languages, but are completely disparate nations spread across small islands. The first book is very typical epic fantasy of the 60s, in that it is a sort of distant view of an epic hero going on a quest. But it largely chronicles the life of a Wizard of Earthsea, Ged, who is known to be one of the most well-accomplished wizards in the world. Later books in the series explore themes of gender equality, which I was very surprised and happy to find. The themes of gender equality are littered throughout the entire series. It's a big part of it, as is themes of race, not through the text per se, but in the decision of who Ursula K. Le Guin chooses to make her protagonist. And that's a very major theme of those books as well.
Right. So,
yeah, because I haven't read any of the Earthsea books, but that was something I've heard about them a lot. Especially, not just in recommendations from friends and stuff, but like even in college, was like talking about how Ursula K. Le Guin deals with gender in the Earthsea books.
Mm-hmm. Yes. She said in an interview, and I can't remember what year the interview was from, but that as feminist literature, the first three Earthsea books were a total bust, as she put it. She said that when she dug deep into her imagination when she started writing these books, she could not imagine a powerful woman as a wizard. And so in the fourth book of the series, 20 years after she'd finished the initial trilogy, she returned and really explored the gender dynamics of the world she'd created through the eyes of a middle-aged shepherd's wife.
Okay.
And it's incredible to make the comparison to Harry Potter once again. Ursula K. Le Guin does, I think, the opposite of what Rowling has done her entire career, where instead of just saying down the road that something has always been a certain way, she has gone back and explored the thing it was she was looking to change or explore in her series.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, not to waste too much airtime on Rowling, but it's like, you know, when she came out and said that, like, Dumbledore was gay. But, like, that never shows up in any of the books. It didn't show up in any of Fresno, which didn't really show up in any of the Fantastic Beasts, like, films either. It's like, it's one thing to, like, just say, like, to make it look like something is more progressive, but, like, it's another thing to actually kind of make the effort to add it in.
Correct. And she spent most of the time she had in Earthsea in her later career exploring the themes of again, gender equality, but also largely just feminism in general in Earthsea. I know she became a powerhouse sort of for feminist literature in her later decades of writing. And she really did take the time to explore those elements later in those books. And it's some of the most interesting stuff to read about.
Nice. It sounds interesting.
Yes.
What does the actual plot of the Earthsea books concern?
So, largely they deal with the life and times of a Wizard of Earthsea. The main protagonist of the book's name is Ged. That is his true name, because names are very important on Earthsea. It chronicles a in-universe text called The Deed of Ged, which is a historical text that chronicles his life. The first book in the Earthsea cycle chronicles a story not told in The Deed of Ged, which is of his childhood and his beginnings in the mastery of power. And the second and third book chronicle major adventures in his life, several decades apart. Later books delve into other corners of the world of Earthsea later on, but largely it returns time and again to the wizard Ged and looks in on him at different points of his life. To that point, the thing that I found so interesting reading Earthsea for the first time is how introspective it is. I grew up on Tolkien and other epic fantasy that dealt with a quest and with battles. And I think similarly to Tolkien, Le Guin cares less about what a battle has to say than what the characters have to say. And so she largely strips away any sort of external conflict in her books. Largely, these are books about introspection and philosophy. Okay. The majority of the first book is just the protagonist desperately trying to right a mistake he personally made, that while the stakes are large and do hold consequences for the greater world at large, most heavily impact him exclusively, almost, I would say, from a majority of the books.
Right.
At least the first one. They are surprisingly, I think, philosophical for a YA series. I was not prepared, I think, for the heaps of Taoist philosophy that is littered throughout the books.
Could you go into that a bit more? Because that's
Yeah, yes, that's something that seems to be like. Yeah, because like a lot of the focus of fantasy seems very Judeo-Christian focused. You know, it's like you look at things and it's quite clearly like this is an analog to God and this is the analog to the devil, and this kind of thing. And you get more and more of that as time goes on with modern fantasy, where you're drawing on different religions and traditions and stuff. Even like back when the Wheel of Time was doing it, was drawing on Buddhist philosophy, which felt a bit of a step forward, but I've never seen or heard anything like draw on Taoist philosophy, so this is really fascinating.
Yes. A great example is again in the first novel, the biggest source of conflict has to do with a shadow that the protagonist accidentally unleashes. But Le Guin makes pains to describe that this shadow is not evil because of some external force. It is evil because it can do harm to others. There is this balance that even wizards have, where it is wizards who could be described as evil are not evil because of something internal with them. It is because they affected the balance of right and wrong and of everything. Evil is not, there is no evil in Earthsea that is evil for evil's sake, because they want to control the world or destroy it. They are evil because of the way they affect others around them. It's one of the biggest examples. And the balance itself is a very Taoist in sort of its central, like, I'm trying to word this right, but like, you know, a good example is the magic of Earthsea also feels very much that way, where everything has a true name. Rocks, the wind, clouds have a true name that if you can learn, you have mastery over it. And a wizard could, if they so chose, speak the name of rain clouds whenever they form overhead to knock them aside. And so it wouldn't rain in that area. However, that everything happens for one reason or another. Everything affects everything else. And if you're constantly knocking away rain clouds, you're in a drought. And that's sort of the primary thing that the wizards have taught in their time at the magic school that is in the first book, is that every action they have has a consequence, and the responsibility isn't just to what they do, but what they don't do.
Yeah, absolutely. And like already it seems like interesting just with the fact that you, even for when you mentioned saying like there's less focus on kind of external conflict and more on kind of like interpersonal things, which I find very interesting. And yeah, no, like I'm gonna have to find like other synonyms for interesting. I think that's a really like kind of quite unique way to look at it, it seems, in the world of like fantasy. Like when were these, refresh me, when Earthsea was published again?
Wizard of Earthsea was originally published in 1968.
Oh, okay.
68 through, I believe, 74 was the initial trilogy.
Right, yeah.
That was the thing for me. When I first started reading them as an adult, I was very shocked, again, for how philosophical it is, how internal it is. Some other things that shocked me for a book written in 68, and I think it's important to consider the time period it was written. The main character of the book is described many times as copper brown in his appearance. Mm-hmm. There is at least in the first three books, one white protagonist. Every other character is a person of color, which Le Guin felt was very important to Earthsea. That, like our world in the grander scale of the world, white people are a minority. That was a big theme that surprised me, considering when it was written.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was kind of sorry.
Does that diversity, like, play into the politics of the world, or, like... Sorry, I don't mean that to sound like... I don't mean that to sound like I'm accusing Le Guin of surface-level diversity, you know, like the literary equivalent of a diversity hire, but like, is it an integral part of the world, or is it, like, has she just put it as like, this is it, you know, in the same way that like in the same way that sort of when you're dealing with, let's say, like a story about mutants, like the X-Men, their position as mutants is like integral to the world that they're in and their position in it.
Yes. While it's interesting, I don't know that I don't think the larger diversity of Earthsea plays into the grander plot of the cycle. However, it does play very heavily into a lot of the themes. A good example, I think, of that would be in the second book, she switches focus from the closer POV of the wizard to a priestess in the singular nation where there are white people. And she really explores the theme of power, whether that be power through gender or power through religion, as it were. And one of the things you learn is that this small nation of white folks who are very imperialistic as our real world equivalents, they are not as powerful as they would have their own subjects or the rest of the world believe, because they are such a small minority. And considering the book was published in 1968, I do believe that is probably a pretty important statement to make.
It's like ahead of the time, so I would have
appeared.
Sorry, I think I got across you there.
No, you're fine. Very much so. And that's sort of the thing with Le Guin that I've discovered in my readings of her and Earthsea, and she was often very much ahead of her time, and when she wasn't, she would course correct, which it's just so incredible. Her work is, I think, largely indispensable as well. And it's such a shame, just for me personally, that it took me so long to get into her work, because I feel like I've wasted time. But to the earlier point, I think thematically the diversity plays into it very heavily. Politically, not so much. Le Guin later in her career played around with political elements in her stories that are largely absent from Earthsea.
Right, yeah. Because, like, I do feel like, my knowledge into her story, Those Who Walk Away from Amalas, like, I haven't read the Earthsea books or anything, but, like, even just from that, like, you know, and from what you've told me, saying, like, her work does seem, like, really significant, and yet she isn't, like, at least, as I know, she's not as, like, you know, kind of, like, ubiquitous as, say, like, Tolkien or, like, other fantasy authors, which, yeah, like you said, it's kind of a shame.
I get the impression that it has partly to do with, the subjects she writes about, you know, I mean, I don't know whether or not I have no idea what the consensus was at the time that some of her books were being written, but for example, her other novel, her other big novel that's in the mainstream as far as I can tell, The Left Hand of Darkness, the protagonist of that book is a black man. And that was also published in the 60s, and I can't help but wonder if she was maybe marginalized for one being for writing about such at the time taboo subjects, or if it was just right, you know, maybe it was because she was ahead of her time. I'm not sure, but it does seem a shame that, you know, we talk about, you know, say Tolkien or later fantasy authors, and she is largely excluded from the conversation, particularly with fantasy.
Yeah.
Is that something that's still the case among readers now today, though? Because, like you said, that you were sorry to essentially have slept on it up until, like, for so long until you discovered it. Like, is that a sort of a thing among readers nowadays? Like, how connected are fantasy readers to the works of Le Guin? Because you see it on, you know, shelves and stuff, and the lists of, you know, best classic sci-fi and all this kind of thing. But, like, how relevant is that, like, tangibly, do you think?
It's an excellent question. It's tough because you're right. You do. I couldn't look very far in my search for more fantasy about wizards before I saw her name come up. But yet, whenever I hear conversations online or in person about fantasy authors, she is noticeably absent, I feel like. And I feel like a lot of people feel the need to include her. I mean, she, you know, was the first woman, I believe, to be labeled Grandmaster of Science Fiction.
Wow.
And yet, I feel like not enough people have put in the work that is reading her material and really exploring it. At least it seems that way to me. It seems, again, like she is largely absent from the conversation of the greats of fantasy, unless it's like some list of recommended reading or the like.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that staying capital, which comes on like classic fantasy now, is adaptations, or not even like the continued adaptations of something like Dracula, which you know, has been adapted so many times, but like The Lord of the Rings was a big book when it came out, and then you had the Peter Jackson films in the early 2000s, which now like everyone has this vision in their minds, and it's thanks to those films. Like, there's a comparative paucity of Ursula K. Le Guin adaptations. Like, there's, as far as I'm aware, there's just the Studio Ghibli adaptation, which was very bad.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. And that's an excellent point. Le Guin is correct, largely missing a big budget adaptation. The first thing I will say
not
to that,
that's the be all and end all of a good story, but
that's true. But it is, I think, in terms of keeping it in the public's eye, it certainly helps. That being said, to that point, I definitely feel like I understand the lack of adaptation. Each of the Earth different from the previous, that if you were to try to make it a trilogy or a series of films, each one would be so disparately different from the last. And also, there are two adaptations of Earthsea. There is the Ghibli one, which is, you are correct, not very good at all. And then there is the one of which I wish I didn't ever have to speak, which was, I believe, the Sci-Fi Channel's adaptation of it from the early 2000s, I think 2002.
No, not a Sci-Fi Channel adaptation of something.
Yes, it's like, no, no.
I'm thinking of the Dresden Files adaptation. No.
That is a pretty is that level good of quality? Comparison of quality. Yes.
No.
When it came out, Le Guin wrote a pretty scathing blog post about it that is an absolute delight to read, but in which she does discuss the issues with it, and it's she was lied to about it pretty explicitly. To what extent I'm not sure. She was told that when they approached her for it, she was told that Philippa Boyens was going to be involved in it, which she co-wrote the scripts for Lord of the Rings. As far as I can tell, she was involved for a time anyway, but by the time the scripts were finished, and by the time filming had begun, Le Guin had essentially been cut out of the process entirely. They had promised her that her biggest issue going into it, of course, which is something she's been dealing with her whole career with Earthsea, is the diversity of the cast. She had recently seen a film that I think Boyens had been involved with before that included a Native American cast, which is what she had been hoping for with Earthsea. And unfortunately, it is this awful amalgamation of the first two novels, where several scenes from the books play out in a completely different order with a completely different meaning behind them. It's also got the budget of a Sci-Fi Channel original, so everything that was incredibly epic about the books looks like utter dog shit. And it's such a shame. I know a few years ago, A24 had picked up the rights to do a television series adapting Earthsea, which I think is the right direction to go in terms of it being a show, but also I feel like of all these studios producing films and TV today, A24 is the one that would, I think, has the correct view, I suppose, the right vision to do Earthsea.
Why is that? Like, I mean, because in my head, I'm predominantly associating A24 with like horror, and I feel like that's like a lot of their more recent output, because like they have done things which have leaned towards the like softer side and just like sort of vaguely supernatural. Like, what is it about A24 that makes them a good fit over, let's say, something like Amazon, who poured millions upon millions of dollars into their Rings of Power adaptation?
Largely, I think it's their willingness to experiment. Earthsea is such a unique series. I think it would be I feel like it would be tough to adapt, because the first book is the first three, all of them to an extent, are so internal. And you know, a good example, the first book is largely the main character by himself exploring the world to find the mistake he made and correct it, which is I think A24, I think about The Green Knight, which came out a few years ago, and you know, that was the first fantasy film in a long time to inspire awe in me.
What a fucking fantastic film. Just, like, visually stunning.
Yes.
Like, because I studied The Green Knight in college, and I was, like, if you had said to me before then, oh, someone's going to adapt The Green Knight, I would have laughed. I was like, how the hell do you adapt a Middle English poem?
Exactly.
Like, props to David Lowery.
Yes. And that's kind of what I'm thinking. If A24 were to adapt, whether it be a series or a film, I don't know how they would be able to wrangle it in terms of, you know, budget and the like. But I would love them to be able to get some really experimental creatives like David Lowery or otherwise on board to direct And I think it would. I think that would work. And again, David Lowry is a good example of a director to have in mind. There is a sequence, and this 60-year-old book, but there is a sequence in which the main character goes to an island where dragons live, and there's this incredible moment where this, what he believes for the majority of the encounter to be a large tower that is, you know, several stories high, turns out to be the neck of a dragon, and it unfurls from all these collapsed buildings, and what he thought was his surroundings were in fact a dragon. And it's moments like that in this book that I picture something directed by, say, David Lowry, or someone who could really deliver on that epic scale.
Yeah. Like, how would you do the adaptation then? It would be like a season per book, or sort of like stretch the thing across multiple each book across multiple seasons to really, like, I know this is sort of the nitty-gritty of a television executive, and I don't want to get down to the level of like, how long do you want episodes to be? But do you think, because like you said with the sci-fi adaptation, like, adaptations suffer so much when they try and smush together a bunch of shit from different books to make one film. And I'm really thinking of Sony's Dark Tower adaptation from 2017, which was just woeful. But like, how would you pace it out? Like, if you're only going to adapt the three books and not, let's say, the sort of ancillary ones where you're, you know, with the shepherd and different other aspects of the world.
If I were to adapt the first three, I think it would have to be either a book per season, or the first two, in a way, do sort of go hand in hand. There is a fairly significant time gap between them. However, they do, in a way, tie directly into each other. Thematically and structurally, I feel, and I think those two could work well together. But I think it would have to be probably at least a short season per book. I think of the first season of the AMC's The Walking Dead, which was only 6 episodes, and that format I think would work very well. I think 6 40-minute episodes would probably get a fairly close look at what these books are like.
Right. Yeah. Because, like, it is kind of tricky when you're adapting a series, because I remember a couple years ago a book series that I read when I was younger, the Town of French's Dublin Murder Squad got adapted to a TV show called Dublin Murders. And for reasons that will forever escape me, they combined the first two books, both of which are pretty big books in their own right, into one season, and I'm like, and had them like happening kind of like at the same time, like, and I was like, why did you do that? Like,
yes, it's a mystery to me. I'll never quite understand the need to do things like that. I have a pretty intense view on adaptations and how they change things to begin with, and I know I'm kind of a stickler for closeness to books, but I've always had issue with the belief that you need to change things for adaptations. I mean, they always say, well, you can't just put the book on screen. Who wants to just see the book on screen? And it's like, I do. That's why I want the book to be adapted. I want to see it.
It's like, why not? Like, it's like,
yeah, because that's also just what's really funny about the Denis Villeneuve Dune films, where like it's split into part one and part two, where he has just essentially taken the book and translated it pretty much wholesale onto the screen. Is that like most of the interesting and exciting things happen in the back half of that book? So like part two is gonna be fucking jam packed with shit, and. You know, like, any other studio would have made, and, like, director probably would have pushed for that to be one film and condense all of the exciting action into one 2-2.5 hour film. And so, like, I really respect the thing to be like, well, we're going to make this a true adaptation, and you're just going to have to wait.
Yes.
Yeah. Because otherwise you could get the 1984, like, try to put the whole book in one film. And that film just apparently isn't good.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah,
it's, I haven't seen it, but I've heard it is not
great. It's not great, no. Yeah, it's such a shame. I think it's a good example of just how ahead of her time she was, that these books are still ripe for adaptation. You know, I think about, you know, The Wheel of Time, which is a series that I do enjoy, and yet those books are a product of their time. I think
right.
Wheel of Time is pretty, while they are, I think, probably one of the first real, like, signs of what modern epic fantasy would look like.
Especially American fantasy.
Correct. While I think they're pretty indicative of that, it's Earthsea is still so relevant today. Everything it's talking about is still at the forefront of everyone's minds. There aren't a whole lot of things you would need to even the things that in the first few books that are could be seen as, you know, a product of its time are not anymore, because she went back and explored those parts of the world deeper, and now they're just parts of the world. I think the best example of that would be early in the first book, there is a line that says, there is a saying where the main character grew up. Wicked is women's magic, weak is women's magic. And that's sort of the view on feminine wizards in Earthsea at the beginning. Witches are lesser magic users. They are to be feared and are to be mistrusted. And there are no women allowed in the wizard school. And then in one of, I believe it's the Tales from Earthsea collection of stories, she shows that actually the school was predominantly, like, women had a major role in the establishing of the magic school. And it wasn't until later that men decided women would make them weak, that they twisted history to fit their needs, and now women who can do magic from tidbits that they can find and do witchery as it is, are now looked down upon, but they are integral to the establishing of magic in Earthsea.
Yeah, so it's like the books aren't even like as dated, even as like as dated as you can, considering they're like 50 odd years old now.
Yes. Correct. The like I said, the elements that were at the time problematic are made not so because she went back and explored them deeper. And those are all throughout Earthsea. And so the books now more than ever, I think, are perfectly ripe for an adaptation. I think now would be the time. I think we're seeing sort of because of movies like The Green Knight and Dune, a sort of resurgence of art films that are getting big budgets. There was also The Northman, I think, last year, that was also a big budget, sort of almost art house film about Vikings. And I think this is the time to explore this world again. As long as, of course, as someone is willing to put in the effort to actually explore the themes that are so important to Earthsea.
Right. Yeah. But you are right saying the idea of, like, you know, getting big budget films that, like, you know, that, like, are a bit different to kind of, like, maybe for, like, Buster. Like, you know, kind of big budget type. Like, I've seen that. I saw The Northman in cinema. I really liked it. Like, and I think, you know, something like that, even if it was for like TV, like for Earthsea, from what you've told me, that could be really cool. Again, if someone is willing to kind of put in that effort, because a lot of the times it isn't just like, you know, I find anyway, the adaptations, it's not just like, you know, putting what happens in the book on screen, like, you know, like that's part of it, but like, you know, it's kind of, you have to understand what the book is about in kind of a bigger sense, a deeper sense, like.
Correct. The spirit of the source is sort of my big thing. I'm a stickler about changes and adaptations, but I can look past it if the spirit and the core of what made the book is present in the adaptation. Which is why I tend to, a good example for that is like It from 2017. I love that film. That's nothing like the book in terms of what happens exactly, but it kept the spirit of what that book was.
Yeah, that's a good film.
And so I think because a lot of the main conflicts of these books are so internal, I think there might necessitate a certain amount of change or adding of conflict. But as long as the conflict is in line with the sort of conflict Le Guin was writing about, I think it's perfectly fine. And that's where the sci-fi adaptation, I think, failed completely. Despite even with the lack of budget, I like, you know, low budget films, and I like films that are, you know, high concept but have little money. But a big source of issue with the Earthsea adaptation from sci-fi was they took elements from the book, like in the nation where the white folk are, there is a god king, and they are imperialistic, and so the god king's sort of imperializing upon and trying to overtake other parts of the Earthsea is a big part of that adaptation. But Ursula K. Le Guin was not interested in violent conflicts. There is some violence in the Earthsea novels, but most of the time the conflict is solved simply because for lots of reasons, but I mean that it's never the good guy kills the bad guy and the world is saved, because good and evil aren't that binary.
Yeah. Like another example I think of is the 1999, I think, adaptation of Haunting of Hill House, which I haven't seen, but like I know that the ending is very much kind of like big, like, you know, kind of like very much kind of like big, like almost movie kind of like conflict. Like, not that you can't do like, you know, more subtle things like on the screen, but like, you know, kind of the stereotypical kind of like, you know, it's very kind of like you said, good guy kills the bad guy and like everything is sorted out, like, and like a lot of people, like, you know, saying like that's just not really what like Hill House was about.
Exactly. And I mean, and I think that it would be pretty easy to explore the concept. Earthsea at its core is a series about power and the responsibility of wielding power and how power affects everything, not just yourself or others, but everything, the world as a whole. And so I think that there are ways to incorporate that theme into a film. I, you know, I'm not a filmmaker, so I can't speak with authority on it, but I feel like someone with some kind of creative talent would be able to put that together. I don't know. It's just a shame in terms of adaptations that Earthsea is lacking so much, because I think it's full of possibilities if someone would just give it a chance, I suppose.
Yeah, this is the thing. It's because I feel like it's like, not to be harping on about, like, you know, the state of, like, you know, films and stuff today, but like it's like, it feels like a lot of like the same kind of stories are getting like adapted and remade and like, you know, kind of like, over and over. Like, the fact that we're getting... like, was it like a new, like, Twilight show? Like, you know, like, less than, like, 10 years after the films came out. And, like, the films which were, like, you know, like, saying, like, obviously not, like, you know, the most, like, critically, like, you know, like, well-received, but were very, like, popular in their own right. Like, you know, and, like, the part of it is that, like, people feel like they can't tell news stories. But also, things like this, like, you know, things that haven't really gotten, like, that kind of, like, same adaptation. I know that, like, Earthsea has had, like, those two adaptations, but, like, just not really being given a chance.
Exactly. And at the risk of bringing her up again, Harry Potter is getting a remake on I guess Max now, which is mind-boggling to me. I cannot believe that that is happening again. It's been 11 years since I think the last Deathly Hallows film was released.
Yeah, give or take. Like, I mean, like I saw it in the cinema, like, you know, it wasn't that, like, it wasn't that long ago.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'm one of the, like, I'm really buying into this conspiracy theory. Like, people think one of the reasons that Netflix cancelled a bunch of shows recently is so they could have the capital to buy the streaming rights to the Harry Potter films, which all just appeared on Netflix there recently. You know, like, they needed to buy all that licensing. And where did that money come from? Quite possibly all the money then they didn't have to spend on shows like Warrior Nun and things like that. And so it feels like this was a sort of weird detrimental domino effect from Harry Potter as well. Just while we're airing our grievances.
So, correct. It's mind-boggling to me. And it's mind-boggling to me. While we're on this, there is something I would like to mention, which I find very interesting. It is very odd to me that when J.K. Rowling talks about her influences. One, she doesn't mention fantasy at all, which is very odd. But also, Earthsea never comes into the conversation. And it's strange, not just because Earthsea is the first book about a wizard school. The setup for A Wizard of Earthsea is a young boy grows up with a cruel set of parental figures who don't particularly care too much about him. At a very young age, right around the age of 13, he learns that he is capable of very strong magic. A gentle giant takes him under his wing and introduces the world of magic to him. He goes to wizard school, makes a lifelong friend, a rival and a rich boy, and has a very recognizable facial scar that aches him when he's nearby. That's the setup of A Wizard of Earthsea, and there are a number of very, very intense parallels between it and Harry Potter that it boggles my mind that J.K. Rowling never once makes reference to it.
Honestly, when you put it like that, there's a part of me that's just wondering, is the reason she's not referencing it is because she thinks people will go back and read that and just be like, hang on a fucking minute.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of this, and not to the extent that that is, not to the extent that Earthsea seems to be a direct source of inspiration for J.K. Rowling. But, like, there seems to be a load of these. Like, people... this is something we discussed on my Discworld show, Nanny Alex Book Club, where it's like there's this character who works in the Unseen University, which is like a college for wizards, called Ponder Stibbins. And in all the illustrations, he looks remarkably like Harry Potter. And everyone was coming for Terry Pratchett, being like, oh, you copied this from Harry Potter, despite the fact that Ponder Stibbins first appeared in 1990.
Yes.
And the illustration of him came out even before the first Harry Potter book was released, which was like, I don't know when the illustration was released, but it was like 4 years or whatever before Harry Potter came out. Mm-hmm. And the DC Books of Magic comic, which the protagonist Timothy Hunter came out, like that also came out in 1990. And like, it kind of like has a similar mop, like black mop top of hair, glasses protagonist, except he has like a screwdriver, I believe, that he like uses magic with.
Mm.
Just sort of like, oh, I need something to use. But like there's so many of these, which I feel like are also then drawing from Le Guin. But it's amazing, yeah. like you say, that fantasy never comes up in this.
Yeah.
That's correct. Rowling, you know, famously, when she is asked what her inspirations are, mentions Shakespeare and Pride and Prejudice and the Bible, which I suppose are possibly inspirations for her some way or another. But I mean, you know, there is Le Guin, which has all of these striking similarities, but there was also the Unseen University. I think even there's even a book, I believe, called The Secret of Platform 13 that is about a portal to a magic world on a train station. I could be wrong.
Oh.
I believe all of those came out before The Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah, like, it's like, I suppose I'd say it's like, it's not even necessarily them trying to say she, like, copied ideas or something, like, not to be giving grace to J.K. Rowling, but, like, it, but that is odd, like, you know.
It is very odd. I can't say that I think she plagiarized, per se. I mean, Harry Potter and Earthsea are so totally different beasts in terms of what they are. I think the best way to sum it up is what Le Guin said about it. She was famous in 2005. She was quoted as saying, "I didn't feel she ripped me off as some people did, though she could have been more gracious about her predecessors. My incredulity was at the critics who found the first book wonderfully original. She has many virtues, but originality isn't one of them."
Ooh,
that's very like kind of what's the word? Like
scathing indictment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, yeah, yes. Fair enough. Get her ass.
Yeah. And
was this another blog post?
That was from, I believe, an interview in 2005. That was...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was with... yeah, that was from an interview of hers. But is she...
Oh, I was about to say that her her blog really is just incredible.
Her blog is incredible, and I cannot remember the name of the article, but it's wonderful that she sort of moved with the times, I suppose. The fact that she moved to the internet to be a voice to her readers is quite wonderful, considering she was writing largely in the 60s. It's her. I find Earthsea also very interesting in the way that it can be compared to other works of fantasy. There are all the Harry Potter comparisons, as I've said, but I think it's important to also take a look at how it compares to Tolkien. Tolkien was largely an inspiration on it, of course. She said that when she read Lord of the Rings, it was like the book she'd wanted to read her entire life that she didn't know she needed. And she was approached, I think, it was her editor who asked her to write a children's book that sort of started her on the path to writing Earthsea. But her idea was, she looked at Gandalf, and this was before the Silmarillion was published, so no one knew that he was an angel yet. And so she, you know, looked at Gandalf, this wandering wizard who seems to live off of the generosity of those he travels and helps, who doesn't seem to have a home or a job or outside of aiding communities. He's ancient. Mm. He knows lots of lots of knowledge and rarely uses magic unless it's absolutely necessary. And her question was, what is a wizard before he's a wizard? Is there a college for wizards? And she wrote Earthsea. But again, it is interesting. She did away with the white wizard, and I'm not just speaking about Saruman when I say that. You look at Tolkien's work, and I don't think Tolkien was inherently racist per se, but he seemed to have a unconscious fondness for a lighter skinned individual, whether intentionally or otherwise. I mean, the Hobbit novel is riddled with, the dwarves of the Hobbit are riddled with stereotypes for Jewish people, and the only people who could be classified as people of color are servants of Sauron or have sided with him in the War of the Ring. And he does take a moment where one of his characters ponders if the soldier he kills is truly evil or if he's just caught up in the machinations of an evil government, but you never meet anybody that is that way. They're just this sort of massive conglomerate force. And
yeah, there's never any Haradrim who are described as swarthy men of the south. There's never any of those fighting on the sides of Gondor and Rohan. Like, the closest they come to diversity is they sort of trick a bunch of people who live in the woods to help them fight, and then they get ghosts. So the ghosts may be minorities, but they're all green, so we can't tell.
Correct. You know, and as I said, I don't know that. I don't think Tolkien was inherently racist, but neo-Nazis love to project onto the Lord of the Rings, and I've never seen one do that for Earthsea. And I'm going to leave that there.
That's your mic drop at the end of the...
correct. I find it fascinating that she took a lot of these elements from fantasy before her and improved upon them and was incredibly original for the time. You know, there's this idea that there's only 30 stories or something like that to tell. And the story she tells is, I admittedly isn't wholly original. It's a coming-of-age story, and yet she does it in such a unique way that I can't help but feel like it is wholly hers, in a sense.
Yeah, because it's like a kind of great sense saying, like, there's only maybe a finite number of stories to tell, and, like, there is, like... So who tells me again comes in, like, how someone tells these stories, and it's like you said, the way she tells it is, like, quite unique.
It is also just, like, deeply moving. You know, she infuses this mystical quality into her writing that I absolutely love. I mentioned when I watched The Green Knight that it filled me with a sense of awe. Le Guin is the first fantasy author, I think, since I read Tolkien at such a young age that I've been filled with true awe at the fantastical. There is a point in the third novel where the main characters pass by an island where dragons live, and they see dragons flying openly in the sky and perched on cliff sides. And the way she describes it is almost religiously. And I've never read dragons written the way she writes them. And I, admittedly, her writing moved me to tears. It was, it's truly incredible. Her ability to evoke intense emotion with only a few sentences is truly, truly inspiring. And that's sort of littered throughout the entire series. There are so many moments where I can't help but think, you know, I've seen that before in a fantasy novel, but I've never felt so moved by it.
Yeah. It's like, in a way, it's kind of like what it means to you as well. It's
like exactly. Being... And it's... You know, it's YA fiction. I don't, and I will admit, I felt cheated when I read Earthsea for the first time several years ago and realized I'd been missing out on it for so long. I don't think my child mind would have fully appreciated what she was doing. I know these books are marketed for 8 to 11 year olds, and I think 8 to 11 is definitely not outside of the age range that could and probably should read it, considering the themes she's dealing with. However, I can't help but feel like it might be lost on someone that young. A little.
It's like, even if they like enjoy it, that like, you know, I feel like there's a lot of things you read as kids, you look back and you kind of, you'll know who's more about them as an adult.
Yes. I wish I had a younger experience with it that I could draw from to see how I would feel different about it. But like, I young me certainly would have enjoyed all of the instances of dragons in Earthsea. There are, you know, lots of seafaring voyages that are very entertaining to read, and encounters with dark magic, but I can't help but think I may have been put off by how intensely focused they are on the internal journeys of the characters. Also, I think I would have missed the POV of the first book.
Right.
That's one of the things I found so interesting reading it now. The first book in this series is the only one where you are in the point of view of a Wizard of Earthsea. Every book afterward is about him, more or less, but you see him through the eyes of others, usually those younger than him.
Okay.
As he gets progressively older. And like the second book, Tombs of Atuan, is when I started reading it, he doesn't appear for over half the book, and it's less than 200 pages, I think. It's...
Oh.
It is... Yeah, it is right at, like, 145 pages, and for about half that time, you're with a completely different character. And I personally love the themes and that she's exploring in the second book about power, especially religious power, and the dangers of aligning yourself with blindly with one belief system. But I don't know that I would have enjoyed it as much as a kid. I think I would have been wondering, where's the wizard at? No?
Yeah, I get that. I feel like that's a good place to wrap it up, unless you have anything else. Yes.
No, I think that's it.
Cool. Nick, where can we find you? Is there any social media you'd like to share, or like anything else you'd want to plug, if you'd like? Is there anything?
No, I keep off social media for the most part. I dropped that a long time ago, but what I will say is hopefully this gets people interested in reading these books. And if you can, I recommend giving it a shot. They're absolutely incredible. That's really it for me, I think.
Nice. Thank you. Nigel, where can we find you?
You can mainly find me on Twitter at SpicyNigel, where recently I've been tweeting about the fact that I sort of forgot I was actually meant to be meeting Aura of Kuang tonight. and then I was left with no way of actually getting to that.
Oh, no.
And also, if I had checked my email, like, because I couldn't sign up to it to get the ticket thing with my main email for some reason, so I had to use a different email. And if I had checked that, I would have seen, like, the event reminder email. So there's that. And then also the fact that I played What Remains of Edith Finch for the first time, and it's just fucking emotionally devastated me. That's a good example of a... something that like tells a story in an interesting way. Like it takes the walking simulator game and does really interesting things with it.
You can find me on Twitter at Alika _ Ali. Find me on Instagram at Ali Ally _ K _ Keegan. You can find the podcast at HyperFixationsP on Twitter.
Or at HyperFixations Pod on Instagram. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, be that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just take credit for someone else's podcast, wherever. If you would like to come onto the show to discuss one of your HyperFixations, please feel free to reach out at any of the aforementioned social media. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you didn't, nobody likes a fucking nerd.
And that is all for this week. Nick, it was a pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Signing off.